This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, December 17th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. In 1995, the Texas oil billionaire Ross Perot founded the Reform Party, promising an alternative to the viciousness and corruption of American politics.
I think as we create this party and as you put it all together, we have got to avoid any divisiveness or the games and things that are historic in politics, and people's desire for power and people's desire for attention and people's desire to be noticed at any cost and so on and so forth, and just stay totally focused on this is all about the future of our great country. This is all about our children.
When Perot ran as the party's candidate for president in 1996, he captured 8% of the popular vote. In 1999, the Reform Party's candidate, Jesse Ventura, was elected governor of Minnesota. But the party's fortunes quickly waned, and by the mid-2000s, it had all but collapsed. There have been other parties, of course, over our nation's history that have come and gone. The Federalists, the Democratic Republicans, the Whigs, the Anti-Slavery Free Soil Party, and the Anti-Immigrant Know-Nothing Party. To younger Americans, the Democratic and Republican parties seem like permanent fixtures with clearly recognizable positions on all major political issues. But are they too mutating into something else? Is the rise of another third party possible? In just 4 years, the Republican Party has jettisoned its core beliefs in favor of Trumpism. The Democratic Party has been infused with the idealism of young progressives. But Joe Biden is already beating back the demands of those who have had enough of old-school politics. Jelani Cobb, a New Yorker staff writer, joins me to discuss whether the future of the two major parties is in question and what can be learned from the parties that were forced into retirement. Jelani, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So until this week, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell refused to even acknowledge Joe Biden as the winner of the 2020 election. And other Republicans on the Hill, as you well know, continue to insist that the election was stolen from Trump. 60% of House Republicans signed an amicus brief supporting a lawsuit brought by Texas's attorney general to the Supreme Court, which they declined to hear, seeking to overturn election results in four swing states. Do you think that the veneration of Trump will cease once he's left the White House?
I do not. I think that, you know, whatever this is, this kind of phenomenon that we're witnessing, that it won't end quietly. And it's kind of an extra political phenomenon at this point, meaning that it's really not determined. It's not contingent upon the behavior of our political institutions. It's the other way around. Our political institutions are behaving according to the prerogatives of this movement. And so combined with the idea that the kind of exuberance that they had at actually electing a person to the presidency and effectively colonizing a major political party has now been replaced by the indignation of feeling that their political right has been stolen from them in the returns of the 2020 election. And so it's largely a function of the particular quirks of Donald Trump's psychology, his inability to concede that he's lost the race. But politically, for the movement that he leads, it's actually pretty smart because they are not going kind of quietly into the good night. They are now actually in a more lost cause phase. They feel that they have been unjustly pushed out of power. And that will become the rallying cry, I think, for the foreseeable future with them.
And it's interesting to see how different kinds of Republicans have responded. So, for instance, there are younger Republicans, and Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri comes to mind, who have really banked their futures on at least selective aspects of the Trump presidency. So as far as the party, the Republican Party goes, what do you see as the future of Trumpism?
Well, it's interesting, you know, because, you know, as you saw, the kind of Never Trump faction was quickly sidelined. And now, you know, very many of those people are no longer even inside the party. And I think we should look at Trumpism as a kind of evolution as a secondary phase of what we were thinking of as the Tea Party, you know, previously. And so I think that, you know, it still becomes a question, can Republicans move away from the kind of ideological, or really not even ideological, because it's ideologically incoherent, but the personality dimensions of the Trump movement without suffering political consequences? I don't think they feel that they can right now. Donald Trump will likely continue to hold rallies, will continue to bay at the Democrats from afar on Twitter or whatever his chosen medium will be, may well launch some sort of media outlet. And these figures might find themselves being held hostage to his whims, and particularly in the way that people were in the previous iteration held hostage to the whims of the Tea Party. And how people can move away from that, I don't really see right now.
And you've written a lot for the magazine about the violent end of this spectrum. And we see these eruptions continuing in Washington with the Proud Boys and Michigan and elsewhere. How do you think those will manifest themselves in coming months and years?
Yeah, and specifically with the Proud Boys, the attack on two Black churches. Yeah, I think that this is kind of a very volatile aspect of the movement that, you know, feels as if it's all dressed up with no one to shoot, as I've been kind of calling it. But I think it would be hard to imagine a scenario where that just fades. There's not a kind of culminating event. And one of the things that makes me, you know, kind of most concerned about this is the fact that when Trump was in office, well, he's still technically in office, but you know, when Trump was prior to him losing the election, people felt on, you know, the right that they had a voice of their own. That if people reached the level of intensity and fervor that they had when they were in power, it only raises the question of how much intensity can be generated if they are out of power, if they are looking at every single action, every single decision, every single executive order that Joe Biden issues as a personal assault or an attack upon their liberty. I mean, there are scenarios where this doesn't happen, I presume. But for me, I've always been really concerned about the potential of this movement to inflict pretty significant damage or pretty significant violence.
So Democrats appear to have their own sort of internal crisis. And at least if the mainstream media is to be believed, Joe Biden has several times felt the need to defend his cabinet choices against critics on the left who say it isn't diverse enough.
Every special interest, and I don't say that in a negative way, every advocacy group out there is pushing for more and more and more of what they want. That's their job. My job is to keep my commitment, to make the decisions, and when it's all over, people will take a look and say, I promise you, you'll see the most diverse cabinet, representative of all folks, Asian Americans, African Americans, Latinos, LGBTQ, across the board.
Given this push and pull, do you see these complaints as symptomatic of the normal growing pains and jostling of a new administration, or is it something more?
Yeah, I think it's something more. You know, I mean, it is that, you know, the kind of jostling of a new administration, but it also extends beyond that. Part of this is a product of what happened in the Senate races. I think the intention, or the expectation, at least, was that Susan Rice would be nominated for Secretary of State. And, you know, if the Democrats control the Senate, that was something that was on the table, something that could happen. If the Republicans control the Senate, that absolutely was not something that could happen. The ghost of Benghazi would have been resurrected, and that would have been the end. It would have been a contentious fight on the Hill to get her approved, and it probably would not have happened. And so with that taken off the table, it meant that the incoming administration could no longer say, look, we have an African-American Secretary of State, and that would have carried a lot of the weight of representation. And so I think what we've seen in the aftermath has been kind of a scramble and an attempt to figure out how they can still meet the expectations of their electorate and still have people who they feel they can work with, you know, in these positions. The other part of it is that, Joe Biden has had an incredible balancing act, you know, which, you know, all political candidates do. But his is, I think, particularly notable because he has run as a moderate. He has said that we want to get back to normal. And at the same time, he is heavily dependent upon people whose primary problem was what we considered normal. And saying that normalcy is what got us into this problem in the first place. And so he really can't, he's dependent upon the energy and the appeal of arguments that people are making on the left. And at the same time, he is as committed as ever to being a force of moderation in American politics.
And yet he did choose Kamala Harris, a Black and Asian American woman who will be the first on two counts, race and gender, as vice president.
Sure. And I think that Kamala Harris is an interesting figure in her own right. And, you know, she is kind of like a Rorschach in terms of when you talk to people politically, people who are in the Bay Area when, you know, she was there and kind of activist left figures who are very critical of her for appealing the decision that could have very well ended the death penalty in California. They saw her as someone who was too favorable to police. And at the same time, there are people who would say that Kamala Harris was about as progressive a prosecutor as she could have been in the time in which she operated. And so she really can kind of make the kind of arguments that work on both sides of that fence. And certainly the other thing that was really notable was the amount of energy and excitement and, quite frankly, cash that came to the campaign after he picked her as vice president, as the vice presidential candidate. There are a lot of people out there with a kind of spectrum of views who thought that Kamala Harris was the right pick for that position.
The idea of big tent politics used to be embraced by both parties. So at what point does it become destructive to the party's aims or even dangerous, as we've been seeing with the Republican Party?
Yeah, I think that, you know, what we call big tent then was kind of a studio apartment compared to what we're thinking of big tent as big tent now. The Republican Party, whether they want to acknowledge it or not, has an openly white supremacist flank. That is something that would traditionally not have been included within the political spectrum. And the Democratic Party, and now ranges from liberal to declared democratic socialist, and trying to corral these almost irreconcilable forces into the standard parameters of American politics is an incredible balancing act. I think that Donald Trump didn't even attempt to. He just kind of catered to the most extreme aspects of his base, and everyone else was held hostage and had to come along. I don't think that would happen with the Democratic Party for, you know, lots of reasons, part of which is that the Democratic Party is, by and large, more moderate.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
Yeah, I think it'd be useful to talk about just how far the Republican Party has deviated from its roots. So I want to call on your expertise as an American historian. Let's go back for a moment to the death of the Whig Party and the birth of the Republican Party in 1854. The Whigs were undone by an internal divide that just simply couldn't be bridged. Could you talk about that and the Republicans' founding principles?
Sure. So it's interesting. You know, the Republican Party comes about as a product of its preceding party, the Whigs, really not knowing how to finesse a single question. And that question was the expansion of slavery. There's the Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854, wildly unpopular. It effectively opens up the door to slavery expanding in ways that it had not been open previously. You know, whereas the Whig Party had pro-slavery Whigs, anti-slavery Whigs, and it kind of was a big tent, this now became a defining question. The party split apart. And two of the immediate repercussions of the Kansas-Nebraska Act were, one, the formation of what became the Republican Party in Ripon, Wisconsin, with a gathering of people in a schoolhouse who were outraged at the idea of slavery being able to expand based upon, you know, a popular mandate. And the decision of a heretofore retired politician by the name of Abraham Lincoln to re-enter the political fray. And the Republican Party is really born out of that moment and saying that there's a question. People are on both sides of it. You really simply cannot any longer have a coalition that entails both sides of this question. So we will definitively come down on the free soil side of this question and then build a coalition around that. That's where they begin. And if we wanted any clear thumbnail sketch of how wildly disparate the Republican Party is from its roots, we would say it began as a party outraged by the idea of slavery expanding in 1854. It is now a party that is home to the majority of Confederate defenders. When people talked about defending the statues of you know, former Confederate figures that were being targeted in the aftermath of George Floyd's death, and even really before that in recent years, the people who came to the defense of those statues were overwhelmingly Republican, including the Republican president, Donald Trump.
Maybe then we can talk a little bit about the Republican Party's Southern strategy, trying to figure out how we got from the original Republican Party to what you were just talking about now, this how they began to increase support from white Southern voters through racist appeals.
Sure. I mean, so in one of the rules of thumb that we should talk about in American politics is that, you know, one, we have not had the same two parties. We've tended to have a two-party system. They have not always been the same two parties. One of the things that we can observe from the reasons around the collapse of the previous parties is that it's tended to happen for two reasons. One is demography. When demography changes significantly, whether that's because of immigration or a significant number of people gaining the franchise, as happened with the 15th Amendment, or even migration of people within the country, it has upset the preceding kind of political status quo. And sometimes parties have collapsed as a result of that. And if we look at the current situation in American politics, really, we can't understand it without understanding a couple of dynamics about the 20th century. In the 20th century, there became this question about what would happen with black voters. This was not really a pertinent question in the South because black people had effectively been disenfranchised, you know, violently. But as millions of people began to pour toward the North in the aftermath of World War I, and especially during World War II, it changed the political calculations. So Northern Democrats now had to contend with the dynamics of there being a significant electorate, people who had heretofore had loyalties to the Republican Party, who were now in their precincts, now in their districts. And when I talk with students, I always say the best way you can understand American politics is to look at the Dodgers after World War II. It was not a coincidence that Jackie Robinson integrated baseball when he did. Branch Rickey was looking around, seeing that there were a lot of black people in Brooklyn and that they had no reason to come to Dodger games. And that led the decision. There are moral considerations, certainly, but the basic profit motive and commercial consideration of saying that there's a new demographic that we have to appeal to was one of the things that facilitated Jackie Robinson's rise. The same thing has happened politically. When we look at Northern Democrats who were largely in control of large cities. And now those large cities are beginning to have significant Black populations, as opposed to the Democratic Party collapsing the way that a party might have in the 19th century. They simply switched places. The Republicans and their previous legacy of having been the party of abolition, the party of Lincoln, the party of the 14th Amendment, and so on, made the appeal under what was come to be known as the Southern Strategy, made the appeal for disaffected whites who felt that the Democrats were going too far in the interests of Black voters. And so we have seen that realignment really shape the way American politics, the political world that we operate in now.
So I want to focus at the end here in this final question on the Republican Party. Given this, what we've been talking about, where do you see the party going in the next 4 years? It sounds as though you think there's no going back to what the party was even during the Reagan era. Are politicians like Josh Hawley or who are picking and choosing from various aspects of Trumpism the future of the party, so it will become sort of unrecognizable from the party we know? New?
I really have thought a lot about this, and I don't know how the Republican Party finds its way back to even the level of moderation it had during the Bush years, the younger years. And so it's a difficult question. And the reason that I say that is that part of this, a significant amount of the appeal of Trumpism has been around demographic anxiety. That the contempt for immigrants and immigration has been a driving force in this. Those concerns are still in existence. Those demographic trends have not changed. And it's one of the reasons I think that we've seen the truisms of American politics just cease to apply. Typically a person, the losing candidate in a presidential election, gets dropped like a hot rock, or a incumbent who loses a reelection bid is embarrassed and humiliated on the national stage. Neither of those things have happened. People seem to have intensified the fervor with which they support Donald Trump. Nothing about that suggests that a moderate voice could move the party in a different direction. And then finally, there's a really interesting book by political scientist Tom Patterson called Is the Republican Party Destroying Itself? And he does point to a number of what he calls binds that the party finds itself in. One is, its donors. The other is its media infrastructure and the way that Fox News has pushed the party to the right and made people really, moderates, really afraid of bucking the rightward gallop of the party, lest they be primaried and wind up as the next Eric Cantor. And so how does that get resolved? And how does that get turned into anything other than a party that increasingly represents a disaffected and diminishing number of white voters?
But how worrisome is it to Republicans that, one thing we saw in this election is that the middle still basically holds in American politics, did we not?
I keep making reference to this old fight, and I think it was 1980, between Sugar Ray Leonard and Roberto Duran. And it was kind of this epic clash. And at the end of it, an interviewer was talking to Leonard, and he said, I threw my best and he threw his best. And the interviewer said, well, what landed? And Leonard said, everything. And I think that's kind of where we find ourselves right now. Everything landed. And, we saw that with the ability to marshal a really outraged, paranoid, angry electorate. Republicans got a higher turnout than they had seen previously, and substantially higher turnout in the presidential election. And so it's the kind of idea, it has kind of erased the easy presumption that Democrats can just ride the demographic tide into enduring political power in the future. That said, we don't know that this is the kind of standard operating procedure. We don't know that that electorate, that that kind of return can be guaranteed by anybody other than Donald Trump. And, you know, it becomes a question, can you have a political party that generates the kind of attention and loyalty and fervor and intensity that Donald Trump represented without the kind of demographic dead-end politics that he articulated?
Good question to end on. Thank you so much, Jelani.
Thank you.
Jelani Cobb is a staff writer at The New Yorker, a professor of journalism at Columbia University, and the author of The Substance of Hope, Barack Obama and the Paradox of Progress. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for NewYorker.com. We're off the next 2 weeks. Happy holidays, and see you in 2021.